Welcome to North Square Investments Active Insights Podcast. North Square Investments is dedicated to bringing differentiated active investment strategies to financial advisors and investors through our multi-boutique asset management platform. Today, Mark Goodwin, Chief Executive Officer of North Square Investments, will discuss the strategies Red Cedar Investment Management believes can enable income-oriented investors to navigate a rising interest rate environment. John Cassidy, Chief Investment Officer, and David Withrow, Director of Portfolio Management with Red Cedar Investment Management, will provide us with their insights. Red Cedar is a partner firm in the North Square platform and sub-advisor to North Square Strategic Income Fund, symbol ADVNX. Mark, John, and David, we look forward to your discussion.
Thanks, Diane. As you mentioned, at North Square, we seek out best-in-class active managers for our platform, and our partners at Red Cedar are well-positioned to help income-oriented investors address the challenges presented by the current environment. John, I'd like to start out first by welcoming you and to ask you generally about the current market. Red Cedar focuses on income solutions and has a highly experienced team. What's your view of the market right now? Do you see the extraordinary levels of proposed government spending combined with the expected return of the economy to some degree of normalcy, combining to create the potential for interest rates to broadly rise over an extended period?
Yeah, well, thanks for having us here, Mark. Yes, certainly the environment we see unfolding right now is kind of this reflationary boom that's occurring right now. And for the, let's call it the short to intermediate term, we think what we see unfolding is positive for the economy. And if things are positive for the economy, interest rates can be rising for very good and valid reasons. And so, yes, we do think that the potential is there for rates to continue to rise. They've risen a lot since August last year already, but still, say, the 10-year Treasury is at a pretty low level at 1.62% as we speak here right now, and it's got a negative real yield. So I think there's still potential for interest rates to rise and normalize more from this point. But so far, I think it's going to be for valid reasons. As long as there is good growth in the economy, and we think there will be, we think there's going to be 7, 8% real GDP growth this year in the U.S., and we think that continues over to the year 2022 at, 5.5%. So as long as there's good growth, there's no reason interest rates cannot rise, and certain aspects of the fixed income market and preferred market could continue to perform even in that environment.
Thanks, John. Turning to you, David. Investors haven't seen a backdrop of rising rates for some time. What challenges does this present to income-oriented investors or investors seeking portfolio diversification from traditional fixed income investments?
Well, Mark, you're right. It does create a challenge because you've got the situation right now where the traditional benchmark, the Barclays Aggregate Index for fixed income, is kind of at historical lows, after a 30, 40-year bull market. And the yields are at historical lows. Along at the same time, the duration or interest rate sensitivity is at its greatest. And so you're going into a low-yielding environment with the potential to offset that if rates rise with price depreciation. And it's just not a great environment if you're looking for income in the portfolio. So that yield, as prices go up, or prices go down, and that yield offset's not there, we have to look for alternatives in the marketplace. And I think that's what investors are doing right now. And there are alternatives out there. There's high quality alternatives out there, but you have to be creative. And probably it's market sectors which have worked over time, but many investors just have not sought at this moment until this moment. And this has kind of spurred everybody to look for creativity. Fortunately, we've been involved in many of these markets for 20 years as a team, but other investors are just finding these nuances available to them.
Thanks, David. In our introduction, we mentioned the North Square Strategic Income Fund that you sub-advise, ticker ADVNX. This fund is a multi-sector bond fund, has a broad range of potential investments. How do you see active management across the range of potential fixed income investments contributing to the ability to address these challenges that we're seeing?
Well, I would say you have to have active management in this world, because otherwise you're taking risk you don't want to take. And you can take very specific risk with that as an active manager. I think first we talked about the interest rate sensitivity of the traditional benchmark. We're able to structure a portfolio with less interest rate sensitivity from the duration measure, which is a strict mathematical measurement of interest rate sensitivity, because we can find alternatives which higher yielding and shorter duration or shorter interest rate sensitivity. And so duration management is kind of the starting point. After that, we can go into sectors such as the preferred, which we have a specific expertise in. Preferred securities are, it's kind of a term of art, but really it includes a vast array of different types of securities. And we are able to kind of go out and select across the capital structure, all the way from senior debt to the equity of a company. But in that little middle tier is preferred securities, which tend to offer higher value because it tends to be an overlooked and inefficient part of the marketplace. So we look for opportunities to jump into these preferred securities. We look at structure, we look at interest rate sensitivity, we look at the credit of the underlying company, and we can find opportunities to trade in and out of the securities, get a high yield, a higher yielding security in a company that may have an investment grade balance sheet, and that creates opportunities. But then even beyond that, we're able to find other securities in the international market, which maybe have lower correlations to the U.S. interest rate sensitivity markets, and maybe offer also higher yields as a starting point. And then there's also periods of time where we can find individual securities which maybe actually have inverse relationship to interest rates. So as interest rates go up, their prices may actually go up in lockstep with that. So that ability to kind of go across the capital structure, look for unique securities, and do it in a portfolio where actually we can buy individual securities which will impact the portfolio and not have to make macro bets, which I think some of our larger brethren out there have to do, is macro bets, because individual security selection can't impact their portfolios.
Thank you, David. Turning back to you, John, you and your team have particularly strong expertise in the preferred securities arena. How would you expect preferreds to perform generally in a period of rising rates?
Yeah, so I think the big story here is certainly there is interest rate risk embedded in the preferred securities market, but there are plenty of other risk factors embedded in a preferred security. So it's not all about the interest rate risk. And where I'm going with this is that they can perform well in a rising rate environment, and history has shown that they have. And just to give you an example here, the other risk factors involved, it clearly there's credit risk involved, there's callability embedded in a lot of these structures, there's regulatory risk, and then even there's put option risk, even in the European market. So there's all this confluence of risk factors that interplay with one another to determine the price of a preferred security. So yes, if you just looked at interest rate risk and said, yes, interest rates are rising, it's got a lot of interest rate risk, then you would say, boy, those types of investment, maybe traditional fixed income, they could struggle in that environment. But we've identified several periods going back to the mid-90s where interest rates have risen, or where the Fed has actually been hiking rates, and preferreds have had a positive return during those episodes. And in fact, we just had a recent episode of rising rates. And if I go back to, I believe it's August 4th of 2020, when the yield curve in the U.S. was at its flattest, and go to the end of the first quarter of this year, the yield curve has steepened. The 2s-10 spread has steepened from 40 basis points to 150 basis points over that time frame. Another way to look at it is the 10-year Treasury went from around 50 basis points to about 1.75 basis points. So certainly a pretty protracted rate rising environment there. And during that time period, the fixed rate preferred index had a positive rate of return of 3.96% over that time frame. So the reasons for that, there are several. Some are the structures of the securities that we own. A lot of them happen to be in the banking industry. And if you think about what improves a bank fundamentally, it would be a steepening yield curve environment where they have the potential for higher net interest margins, better capital positions as they earn more and more, you know, have better earnings over time. So these things all go into it. So credit spreads can be compressing while rates rise during that environment that I just described, and you can end up with a pretty decent, reasonable return. So yeah, they can indeed provide a good return even while rates are rising.
Thank you, John. How do you think this compares to your expectations for other areas where investors have sought yield historically, in particular high yield securities and emerging market debt? As we know, as rates continue to rise, the dollar oftentimes strengthens, and that can provide a negative backdrop for the EM arena. But thoughts on high yield and EM debt as in this environment?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. If we look historically going back 15 years, preferred's correlation to investment-grade fixed income is 0.15. In other words, they're not very correlated at all, which is a positive for your preferred holdings if rates are indeed rising. But high yield can certainly be has higher correlations, and especially high yield investors can have higher correlations to the equity market, especially when things are going poorly in the high yield market. So you absolutely have to be concerned in high yield. I mean, it's a much lower credit profile than the preferred market, so you've got that to contend with. And as you mentioned, yeah, emerging markets, you're going to have much more volatility in high yield and emerging markets than you would in preferred. So it would give you a perhaps a better return profile potentially with dampened volatility relative to emerging markets and high yield. And as you mentioned, yeah, you can have a strong dollar. You've got the currency risk to contend with when you're investing in emerging market fixed income as well. It's like the blitz in football. You live by it and die by it. Same thing can happen in the world of EM investing when you're sitting there taking currency risk. Sometimes it goes your way, but other times it might not.
We mentioned earlier the importance of active management in this environment. Are there specific nuances to the preferred space that would give an active manager an advantage?
Yeah, absolutely there are. And I would point to probably two things. Number one, the structure of each individual security. You absolutely have to pay attention to that. What are the callability features of it? And then once you get to the period when it is callable, typically some of the securities we invest in, they're called hybrids, and they'll be fixed rate for a period of time. And then when they get to the call date, they go to a floating rate interest rate structure. So you have to pay attention to what type of floating rate are you getting? What are the margins? Are they skinny margins on the floating rate, or are they nice big ones? That all plays into our calculus on what to invest in. And then the other nuances I would say is certainly there's an interesting dichotomy between the $25 preferred market, or what we'll call the retail preferred market, and the more institutional market. What happens many times in the $25 preferred market is a lot of things in that marketplace can get mispriced. We've witnessed over the past, you know, as long as we've been doing this, that mispricings occur when certain $25 structures will end up trading at negative yield to calls, which does not make any economic sense. And so we've been able to, as a total rate of return manager, active manager, we can own $25 preferreds when they look cheap relative to their hybrid brethren, and we'll own them. And if they rich enough, and if they get to the point where they're trading at negative yield to calls, we're happy to sell them and go into cheaper bonds in the institutional space that have the similar characteristics in terms of where they sit in the capital structure, but it's just the mispricing that takes place that we can take advantage of.
Thanks, John. Would you say that your overall exposure to preferred securities provides a certain degree of diversification to your portfolios that investors might not get from more traditional fixed income investments?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say that. And I point back to a comment I made earlier, absolutely, about the correlation benefits that you're getting relative to traditional fixed income. Over the 15-year period, preferreds relative to investment-grade domestic fixed income have that 0.15 correlation to the Bloomberg Barclays Ag Index. So you get a diversification there. And just once again, I think if you get an active manager involved, there are other ways that you can make total rate of return by investing in preferred. So it's not as inefficient as a marketplace as maybe some more highly traded fixed income securities. So I think that's where you also get some diversification benefits.
Great. David, turning back to you, as we mentioned earlier, you folks sub-advise ADVNX, the North Square Strategic Income Fund. Thank you again for your partnership there. Could you comment about how the current portfolio for ADVNX Strategic Income is positioned?
Sure. And Mark, we've certainly enjoyed it. We've been managing similar strategies for most of our careers, and we think it's a great way to kind of showcase the best of the talents of the team. Currently, you know, let me start with the bulk of it. So when you look at kind of the fixed income space, which is really the core of the portfolio, right now, you know, we went from a low, the range on preferreds can go anywhere from 30 to 50%. We went from a low kind of in the crisis and during the pandemic, down near that low end of the range around 30%, and now we're closer to 45%. I want to get a little more fine-tuned than that because John mentioned several different types of preferred, and we really kind of lump them into three buckets. There's the $25 preferred, which is probably what most retail clients are familiar with, and it is geared toward a retail kind of high net worth client base. Then you have hybrid securities, which look more like bonds. John mentioned a lot of them are fixed to floating. So they start out as a fixed rate coupon, they go to a floating rate. And then we have the contingent claim, AT1, is kind of what the European banks have issued. So there's COCO, hybrid, and $25 preferred. We used to be very heavily weighted toward the $25 preferred. Over the last year, we've kind of migrated to the hybrid. So hybrids are about 31% of that 44%. The COCOs are just under 8%, and the $25 par around 6%. About 23% of the portfolios in what we call securitized, so think residential mortgage, commercial mortgage, and asset-backed consumer loan types of securities. It's probably not your garden variety of type securities, but that's where we can find very unique opportunities. Again, we're looking for unique securities that probably are under-evaluated by the street, where we can find relative value that maybe the rest of the street's not unearthing. And so that's about just under 24%. We do have about 8% equity exposure, which is towards the high end of the range. We max out at 10% there. That equity exposure, we prefer, and not that we won't take high yield, traditional high yield, but if we're looking at high yield exposure, which is heavily correlated to equity, we'd rather have the upside benefit of actually owning the equity. We're fairly bullish on the equity market right now, but we really are a bottom-up manager on there, so we have names in there that we really like, and so we're at 8%. REIT equity, we're at just about 5%. Interestingly enough, in that bucket, you'll find some interesting, there may not be your traditional REITs, but they're called mortgage REITs. Suffice to say, they provide a significant amount of income. A few months ago, we started buying, sometimes our dividend yields were double digits, 10 to 12%. Several of those have actually performed exceptionally well. Have been some of the biggest contributors on an individual name basis. And then we also have just about 5% exposure to non-dollar. And those are names, the Mexican bonds denominated in pesos, where we felt the yield advantage was significant to the U.S. We also felt that the peso could perform well against the dollar. And it actually worked for quite a while. Recently, that's tailed off a little bit, but in net, it provided very substantial performance, both on a yield basis and the appreciation on the currency with that one. So we have exposure there, again, around 5%. We probably will be continuing to look to add to those positions because we think, again, when we can diversify the portfolio globally, we continue to diversify away from, a lot of it's interest rate risk that we're trying to diversify away from, and that's a great opportunity to do that. We have hedged out some duration using derivatives, and these are simply treasury derivatives. The exposure there really is to kind of get the duration. We're about 3.5-year duration, which is really just a measure of interest rate sensitivity. So those are really the broad buckets of the positioning, and happy to go into more detail on those, but I think that gives you a good idea how we're positioned today.
Thanks, David. For income-oriented investors that may be new to the Strategic Income Fund and Red Cedar's approach, how do you suggest they should think about your multi-asset income strategy as they look at it as a specific position in an overall investment portfolio?
As I mentioned, we've been managing this strategy for a long time, and we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And we believe that it really, as people are rethinking, again, this is kind of a theme right now with low interest rates, as people rethink what does it mean to have a core fixed income strategy, the traditional views just don't work anymore. So we view this could be a core position in a portfolio which might take the place of a traditional fixed income strategy. And it doesn't make sense just to allocate it because historically this is what it's done. There is by nature asymmetric risk in fixed income. And although it's a little bit been thrown out the window, you kind of have this arbitrary, 0% yield is about as low as you can go. And why would you buy a negative yield like you have in Europe right now if you don't have to? So this gives you an opportunity to get yield in a portfolio that has really low correlations to both equity and the fixed income traditional products. Another way we've seen clients use this is as a complement to other funds, which may source their alpha in a different direction, such as traditional high yield or emerging market. Again, we're not against those asset classes. It's just typically we're not where we source the alpha in our fund. But when you pair us with other funds who maybe use those asset classes, you see a pretty good, in many cases, a pretty good risk paradigm emerge when you run the statistical measures on upside downside capture and when they're outperforming versus when they're underperforming. And so we pairing it with another fund which may operate a different type of strategic income strategy is often found to be a good way to implement this.
Thanks, David. You had mentioned earlier about the potential for some of these securities to be called. How do you think we should think about call risk in this particular environment and in general for preferred securities?
You really have to view it as when we buy our preferred securities, sometimes it's viewed as call risk. We want the security to be called. We're buying it with the intention it's called. I would say most of the time. There are times when we don't want it to be called, but most of the time we're buying it with an eye toward it being called. And many of the securities are structured with the intention that they will, the economic incentive is there to be called. It's not quite as the gentleman's handshake agreement as it used to be in the marketplace where companies could call it at a whim, but there still is ways to buy securities where you have some certainty. Now, that when you're buying a fixed rate that's fixed for life, you kind of have to do the same analysis on that you would a callable bond. There used to be a lot more callable bonds in the old days when I first got in this business, and the negative convexity or the sensitivity where the bond performed exactly opposite how you wanted it to. So we make sure that we have a good balance of the ones that go fixed to floating. That fixed to floating feature, again, is an incentive that even if you are holding onto the bond, they don't call it. Now that you're a floating rate, you're going to go with where interest rates go anyway. So we do actually own some floating rate bonds which have converted to floating rate, which aren't going to be called, but we like that sensitivity to the short part of the curve. And then, frankly, Mark, there's other bonds we purchase where they're floating rate, but they're floating to the higher yield of either short-term rates, 10-year or 30-year rates, and you get the highest rate. So it really works well. There's a couple scenarios where it doesn't perform well. But in the market scenario we're in now, where you have 30-year yields rising and the front end of the curve held steady, it actually performs very well. All that becomes a part of our analysis. And then really it goes back to what John was talking about, where active management is very important because you want to be fully aware of these covenant structures built into these securities.
Thanks, David. We're at an interesting inflection point, particularly with the rally post the downdraft in the market last March has been really impressive. And many investors might find themselves uncomfortably overweight equities right now, but still a bit uncertain about moving more into traditional fixed income investments given the potential for rising rates. How do you see the Strategic Income Fund, ticker ADVNX, perhaps being in a better position to put them on good footing for a rising rate environment?
Well, and Mark, I think the ADVNX portfolio really speaks to that because you're right. It's hard to go from an equity portfolio if you're trying to hit a target return or get any return. It's hard to justify selling equities right now to go into an aggregate benchmark, interest rate sensitive, low yielding portfolio. And it'd be hard for me to justify that in a portfolio. But what ADVNX provides is an opportunity to not sacrifice yield and actually, probably pick up yield versus, S&P 500 in many cases. But also have some upside potential. So you're right. To go from equities to a traditional approach, it's a tough sell. And I don't know that I would sell that. But I think when you look at a portfolio like this, you don't have some of those same risks, especially with interest rate sensitivity, where we're, call it, a little more than half the duration risk of the traditional benchmarks. And so the interest rate sensitivity is much less. We get an extra yield, and that yield will cushion some of that price depreciation even if rates do go up. And we also can buy securities which are less sensitive and have lower correlation to interest rates in general. Some have negative correlations to the fixed income marketplace. All those really, I think, provide a great foundation to say, hey, if you're wanting to kind of take back your risk a little bit, here's a way to do it and not kill your returns on your portfolio over time.
And hey, can I just throw something else in here as well? There's a lot written about kind of the traditional 60-40 portfolio is dead with interest rates where they're at, and it's going to be tough for fixed income to buffer you in the event you have a downdraft in the equity market. So to David's point, yeah, I think this is the way you would want to own fixed income, and I'll just tell you this. The Bloomberg Barclays Ag Index returned minus 3.4% for the first quarter. So down 3.4% in one quarter of the year. That is the worst start to the year ever for that index, okay? So that kind of speaks to, is fixed income going to help you out? Clearly, equities were doing their job during that time frame, so all's good. But a negative return on fixed income during the quarter, in this strategy, it had a positive return during the quarter. It was, now, albeit a positive 7 basis points, but nonetheless, it had a positive sign in its return when the fixed income had its worst quarter ever, or worst start to the year ever. So that's what I would add.
Thanks, John. As a capstone comment, I've enjoyed following you guys for a long time now, and I like multi-sector bond funds in general because it allows managers to be creative in what they do. I like the fact that managers in the space can go across the globe, and I especially like the fact that you guys can go across the cap structure very nimbly. So thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great conversation as always.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for tuning in to our North Square Active Insights podcast. For more information on North Square Investments, our partners, and investment solutions, please visit our website at www.northsquareinvest.com. Nothing contained in this communication constitutes tax, legal, or investment advice. Investors must consult their tax advisor or legal counsel for advice and information concerning their particular situation. This podcast contains certain statements that may include forward-looking statements. Although Red Cedar Investment Management believes that the expectations reflected in these forward-looking statements are reasonable, they do involve assumptions, risks, and uncertainties, and these expectations may prove to be incorrect. Actual events could differ materially from those anticipated in these forward-looking statements as a result of a variety of factors. You should not place undue reliance on these forward-looking statements. This podcast reflects Red Cedar's views and opinions as of the date herein, which are subject to change at any time based on market and other conditions. We disclaim any responsibility to update these views. These views should not be relied on as investment advice or an indication of trading intention.